This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, how you doing? I'm Craig Parkinson. You are listening to the Two Shot Podcast. Sit yourself down, pop the kettle on. We're going to have a nice old chat. Who's it with this week? I'm going to tell you right now. Hello, it's me. Oh, right there. How the devil are you? Is that better? Yeah, it's me. Hello, I'm back. Don't be like that. I understand. I understand your frustration. Trust me, I've been frustrated too. Apologies to everybody. I know it's there's been a slight drought in episodes over the past few weeks. What? What's your excuse, Craig? Well, I've been really busy. It's been super busy. And also, you know, I'm a bit of a stickler. I want to always find the right guest for this podcast. Of course, people ask to come on. But sometimes I just don't think it's a good time or it's a good fit. But this week, I am thrilled to welcome the actor Mark Bonner. And my God, it is a perfect fit. I loved this conversation, loved talking to Mark. Look, you're going to know Mark from his groundbreaking performance in Line of Duty in Series 2. And his beautiful, hysterical, heartbreaking performance, and that's not an oversell, in Catastrophe. It was on Channel 4, if you're in the UK. And look, just to put it out there, you know what these conversations are like, especially when I'm talking to actors. We kind of don't really get into the ins and outs of the acting world. Well, on this episode, we kind of do, but don't, no, come back. It's fine. There's no asides, there's no in-jokes. We kind of approach it from a very human aspect of the business and work and ethics and rejection. So it's something that, you know, everybody can take something away from it. And I really think that you get such an essence of who Mark is. And we talk about, you know, the side of family man Mark and I'm going to work Mark and the slightly versions, there's personas, but it's a great conversation. And I'm so thrilled that after a few weeks off, we are kicking it back off with the majestic Mark Bonner. What else do I have to tell you? Well, also, the second apology. And don't think that I don't know about this, that I am aware of this. That, yeah, I'm really proud of all the episodes that we've been doing over the last 4, 6, 8 weeks. But one thing is, they've all been very male heavy, and we pride ourselves in casting the net far and wide with our guests. But don't worry, we've got some incredible female guests coming on. It's just about timing. The timings have been so frustrating of late. So don't think that this has turned into Craig Just Talks to Blokes podcast, because you know it ain't that, and it will never be that. things are going to slightly die down for me work-wise when I finish this other job towards the end of this month, November. And myself and Griff are going to get in the car and we're going to go and do a few days of live, not live shows, that's next year, sorry, live one-to-one recordings in person. I'm not going to be in front of a computer and it's going to be great. And I can't wait. So we're going to stockpile a load of episodes. So you're going to have new episodes coming throughout December and into January. As always, over the Christmas and New Year period, you won't be without an episode. I promise you that. Okay? Trust me? That wasn't a question. You trust me. That still sounded like a question, didn't it? Anyway, I hope you trust me. We'll sort it, I promise. Anyway, it's brilliant to be back, and I'm so pleased you're here. Well, should we get down to it? I think you've waited long enough. Get your brew, get your piece of toast. Depending on what time you listen to this, get your glass of wine. Okay? Okay, ready? Okay. This is the Two Shot Podcast with the brilliant Mark Bonner. Enjoy. And I shall see you at the end. It looks a little bit like I'm interrogating you for some sort of Stasi crime.
Kind of, you know, that might fit in with
be quite
the
apt,
way we first met. Where are you on the night of the 25th? I was at my gran's house.
Back it up. Prove it. We were talking before when we were just sorting out some tech issues about you were asking me if I'd seen Bull, which is Paul Andrew Williams' new film starring our good friend Neil Masker, which I was supposed to see
on up in
Saturday
Manchester.
So I was finishing off some filming in Liverpool on Friday.
And
I got back home. Pop the heating on. I was about to pour a glass of wine, have some food, and I get a phone call from my mum, and my dad had been admitted to hospital, and he had a fall, and then they found something, and it was just having some tests done. So I rushed up over to Blackpool to sort of be with my mum and just sort of calm that sort of, you know, that you know, the rocky waters there. But everything's fine, and he's going to be out. So no, he's comfortable at the moment, and we're just awaiting some news. But I'm sure he's going to be fine. But no, is the answer. I didn't see it, but I am looking forward to seeing it.
Oh, mate,
very
Jesus,
soon.
Sorry.
But yeah, if it wasn't one thing, it was the other. You know, best laid plans.
Oh,
yeah,
poor
that.
Dad.
No, I know, but he's comfortable and he's resting. But it did get me thinking because. I raced over from Manchester and my younger sister drove up from where she lives in London. And we were kind of tag teaming because she knew that I was back in Brighton filming this week. And I spoke to her this morning and she's got a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old. And she had a 4-year-old in tears on the phone yesterday because, you know, she's not in our industry and she's never away this long. Oh. So she's got, you know, daughter's guilt and mother's guilt. And then I was thinking, and I said to my sister, I said, well, it's different with my son because he's used to either his mum being away for, you know, lengthy periods or his dad being away. And it got me thinking again because a few weeks ago somebody asked me how I would feel if my son went into the industry or had aspirations to go into it. How? Because you've just been doing bedtime stories now, haven't you, with your daughter?
Well, my wee boy, yeah. No, I've just been reading them. I don't do them with my daughter anymore. My daughter sort of like, she's a faster reader than I am. She just like races through books. But I love reading with my wee boy. He reads me his school book and then I read him. At the moment, it's we've worked our way through not all the Roald Dahls, but a lot of the Roald Dahls. And we've started Harry Potter. And Harry Potter, it's quite interesting, actually, because I'd never read it out loud before. I've read the first four myself years ago when they first came out. And I really liked them when I read them myself. But reading them out loud, the first one, anyway, isn't that conducive to reading out loud. It's quite interesting. It's that sometimes the syntax is sort of a little bit muddled and words come where you wouldn't expect them to come. And it's just, it doesn't flow very well, I don't think, interestingly. I'm loving reading it, though. It's a great, you know, and he loves it because she loves it so much. Martha loves it, you know. Samuel's kind of like, you know, I'm all grown up. I'm reading Harry Potter with Dad, you know.
But there is something so comforting to having a story read to you when you're a child.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I remember getting there. Actually, I remember being read to? I was going to say I remember being read the Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, but I read that myself. The Magician's Nephew was the very first book I read by myself, and totally loved it. I read about three of them, I think. I got kind of lost around about Prince Caspian because it was, I stopped caring about them, I think.
But when I fell out around sort of Voyager the Dawn Treader, which is around...
Yeah, that was really hard, wasn't it? That was number... Is that not number seven or six? I can't remember.
It's quite far on. It's just after Prince Caspian, I think, but yeah.
Oh, yeah, maybe it is. Maybe you're right, yeah. The Last Battle's the last one, isn't it?
Yeah, I never got to that.
I got a bit bored. I think The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe's a great story. And The Magician's Nephew's good. I read that first.
Yeah, well, The Magician's Nephew is the first one, isn't it?
Well, there's debates about what's supposed to be first. My dad always told me that Magician's Nephew was first, so
yeah,
that's
me
the
too.
One I read. I don't really remember being read to. I don't think I must. I would have been younger, you know. But it's great to. It's a great thing to share with your kids, isn't it? It's a lovely thing to do, especially with Roald Dahl. Roald Dahl really does read well out loud. And Danny the Champion of the World was one of my favourite books when I was wee. And he just loved it when I read it to him. And he was speaking about all the characters and going, oh, Dad, that bit last night where blah, blah, blah. You know, it really fires their imagination. There's a reason he's the best, you know.
Yeah.
Stands up, even though there's some... slightly politically, well, not even slightly politically incorrect. There's quite a lot of politically incorrect stuff.
Lots of very much
people,
so. But...
And there's lots of ugly people, you know.
Which
you wouldn't rightly get away with these days.
I was trying to explain to my son a few years ago when he was much younger, when we were reading George's Marvelous Medicine, about, I said there was a man who I adored when I was a young called Rick Mayall, and he was a comedian, Hardy, and he. Do you remember, Mark, when Rick Mayall read George's Marvelous Medicine for Jack and Ori?
No, I've never seen it.
Oh,
I've seen clips, I think, but I've not.
I'm sure it's available on YouTube. It is. I remember rushing home because he told the story of George Marvel's medicine in a full week on Jack and Ori. I remember rushing home and it was like, you know, we talk about appointment television now. Well, my God, this is appointment television. You've never seen anything like it because it was like he was just ripping up the set. He was being Rick, but he was doing George's Marvelous Medicine. And it was so, it was like Jack and Ori, but punk rock. I mean, it was... Yeah. Incredible. But for me to try and explain it to my son was... Anyway, I tried to channel my inner Rick when I was reading George's Marvelous Medicine. But yeah, it's a lovely time. But when somebody asked me that question about how I would feel about my son going into this industry, I was a bit lost. I was a bit lost for words. I didn't really know because I just thought he's 10. I don't know. Has anybody ever asked you that about your children?
Yeah, well,
just
not
considering,
asked.
You know, both you.
I don't think anybody's outright said, how would you feel about it? But, I mean, they're both quite, in their own ways, they're both quite sort of... they like performing in their own ways. But I mean, all kids do, I think. You know, that's a part of growing up, isn't it? That kind of thing. Play acting is a part.
I think
of
all kids.
Up.
Well, all kids should. And yes, I think they do in their own way.
Yeah, I think they do too. And I think that's, you know, I mean, they know obviously what we do for a job, and they know they've never really seen us, and they've seen a little bit of Porridge. Martha watched an episode or two of Porridge when I did that a few years ago. But because most of my stuff, I mean, they watched Bedtime Stories when I did that, which was one of the great joys of my life. But they've never really, they don't really, yeah, it's kind of, I suppose they just sort of take, like I did, you know, my dad was an artist, is still an artist, and you know, it was never really, it was just like what he did. That was what he did. So I don't know if they think about it that much. I mean, yeah, I don't know how I would feel about it. I mean, do you know what? I would be worried, but I would, I'll be worried about whatever they, I'll be worried about whatever they say they want to do. You know, I don't you never stop worrying. That's my mum still says that to me now. You never stop worrying, even though you're 52. I still worry about you, you know. I think that's just part and parcel of being a parent, along with all the fun stuff and all the hard work. You also worry a lot about them because you do, because you love them and you love the bones of them and you want them to be happy.
It's a tricky thing with children, full stop, because, yeah, I mean, I think mums are just the same. My mum's the same as yours. They never stop worrying, really.
Yeah,
as we won't do with our children.
No, neither does my dad. I mean, neither of them do. I know that we both, you're constantly, because they're such a massive part of your life, and you've kind of, you don't realise before you start out doing it, being a parent, how much it's going to take out of you, how much you're going to invest in them, how much you're going to get wrong. And how much you're going to love them. I think, you know, that's the, all those things that are, you just, and how tired you're going to be and how frayed you're going to be and how uncertain. And, you know, these are, it's a really difficult thing to do. I'm lucky, you know, I'm really lucky that, that we've got me and Luce, well, I'm lucky to have Luce, but in full stop, but we've got such a brilliant kind of honesty in the relationship where we're very, you know, and she's very good. She's much better at it than I am. I think I'm quite kind of, I'm not communicative, as a person, particularly. You know, I think I kind of either just sort of like mosey on like dwami and my head in the clouds, or I kind of keep things to myself. And she's very good at encouraging me to communicate better. Thank God.
Mm.
Because that's funny, what you need.
That's what you need. But it's funny because, you know, we've known each other for a few years. I've never thought of you like that. I've always thought of you as very open and very approachable and very communicative.
Well, I am in some ways. I think I think you have to be, don't you? You have to be, you have, like everybody does, everybody has their work persona, you know, and who they are at work and what they do. And then they have their home persona and, you know, and it's very, especially with our job, you have to be kind of open and you have to be, you have to throw yourself into things and you have to throw yourself at people, you know, who you don't know, to, you know, emotionally to kind of, you know, connect with them, and because you're all on this thing, you're in this boat together that you've got to set sail on, and, you know, oh dear, I'm starting on a metaphor. I'm going to stop there now.
No, but you're right.
You have to. You have to sort of. You have to launch this. Yeah, I heard myself say in an interview the other day, I heard myself say, what was it about, something about shepherd, it's like I'm a shepherd or something, and then I went, don't you dare fucking print that, because that's the wankiest thing I've ever said in my life. But you do, so you have your work persona where you're open and you're kind of, yes, you're communicative, and then, and you have the real you, which is kind of like, which is not like that.
No, but you're right, because you have
I am to a certain extent. I'm doing myself a disservice, probably.
But yeah, I think you are a little bit, yeah, mate, definitely. And also, because you have to forge those relationships very quickly with people that you don't know and you don't have a history with at all.
Yeah.
And you have to be open to be trusting people, which is a big ask.
Yeah, it's huge. It's weird. You sort of get used to it, though, don't you? I mean, you kind of, because everybody's the same. We're all the same. We are all, well, all the good people are, you know, the nice people, the ones that want to do well and aren't interested in their ego, are in it because they know it's a team sport and they like playing the team sport, you know? And so you launch yourself at each other and sort of go, let's discover this together, you know? And yes, there's not everybody's like that, but there's all kinds of different personalities. But generally speaking, I think actors are a great bunch of people. I've had very, very few bad experiences in my life. Touch wood. Long may that continue.
Yeah.
I love the job. So going back to your original question, I'd probably be very happy if they decided to do this, as well as worried about how the fuck they were going to make ends meet, because, you know, as you know, that's what you're always worrying about in this job, is what happens if it stops, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And also the rejection.
Yeah.
The pretty much constant rejection for many years.
Yeah. I mean, that's another thing, though, you kind of get used to, isn't it? Don't you? Or, I don't know.
I think, well, I was thinking about it before when I was going, well, how do I do? Does that sound negative if I start having a conversation with Mark about rejection? Well, no, because he understands and it's not going to start. I didn't want to start off talking about rejection, but, and it's funny you ask about getting used to it, because I was thinking, have I got used to it before you've asked that? And I think I have. And sometimes it can last. Whereas sometimes maybe years ago, it may have lasted a week and it may have kept coming back. Now it's a good 25 minutes of unhappiness and anger and frustration.
Why did I not get a fucking... I'm better than he is.
Oh, same old, same old. Great.
Yeah. Again. Oh, they've gone for him again. Right. See him everywhere.
And then I come back from halfway through throwing the telly in the backyard and I think, no, I'm not going to do that. I'll put it back in the living room.
But yeah, I think you're right. I do. Yeah. I think it does. You're right. Earlier on in my career, I remember that rejection being really lingering, especially if it's something you're invested in, especially if it's something you think you can do as well, or really excites you, or both, you know, then it can be, and that can still be hard to take if you think you'd be good at something. It's still, there was a couple of things recently I had actually that I was like, oh, really? I was kind of in my head. You know what it's like in your head? You sort of, now and again in idle moments when you're, you know, I don't know, in the toilet or, you know, wherever you are, where you're sort of sitting thinking, oh yeah, I'm waiting to hear about that job, haven't I? And you have a you know, 10, 20 second flight of fancy about doing it. Yeah, I could do that. And then you wipe your arse and wash your hands and it's gone. I think it does get better with time. Rejection does get better with time, or you just get more used to it because it happens more. It's happened for 25 years, so you're sort of like, well, You know, that's what it is. It's you learn, you get used to the business. It's tough, but you get used to it, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's a bit like what we were saying about you're starting a new job, you're forging these new relationships because this is what you do. And we're all of the same team. The first is the same, the drivers are the same, the runners are the same, the team is the same. We all know that we're embarking on something new and everybody's, and even I was working with a girl the other week and she was fucking brilliant in this scene. She was brilliant. And we were in the car on the way back and she said, oh, I'm going to go back to London now. So everything all right today? Did you have a good day? Because she was in more scenes than me and I just popped in and did a couple of scenes with her. She went, it's my first ever job. I went, you're joking. It's your first job. And she just went, yeah, it was really great. But I mean, I know what I was like in my first job. Terrible.
Me too.
Like, terrible. This girl was
really terrible.
Solid as a rock and cool. Super, super cool and brilliant. She just, I said, oh, was everybody really sound and really nice? She went, yeah, everybody's really lovely. I went, brilliant. As long as everybody was lovely.
Some people arrive fully formed, don't they? It's taken me a long, long time to learn how to do it. And some people kind of, not learn how to do it, but like hone down the rough corners and especially when it comes to camera work, you know, just learn what doesn't work and blah, blah, blah. Because somebody sent me a clip of it wasn't my very first telly, but it was my first sort of biggish part on telly, which was, it was an Inspector Rebus with John Hannah years ago. And as somebody said, I was working with the sound guy's son, who's also now a sound guy. And his dad sent me, he had it on, I don't know, whatever, DVD. And he filmed a wee bit of it off his telly and sent it. And he showed me and I was like, oh my God. I mean, apart from that, I've got hair and it's brown. But I was just, you know, just what I could see what I was doing. I could see what I was doing. You know, it was all very considered and self-aware, and it's interesting how it takes you a long time to lose that, doesn't it? That kind of maybe if I look here, I mean, I still sort of have a little eye, a third eye on it, you know, all that position. Why you have to?
Yeah,
but it's just about being relaxed. Oh my God, I wasn't relaxed. But some people, like that girl you were talking about, they just sort of go, "Here I am, and I know how to do it." And you're like, "Oh, you bastard."
Yeah, she seemed really grounded and really relaxed, but I was just so pleased that she'd had a brilliant first day.
That's nice, yeah.
Because it's really nice because so many people don't. Or
I know.
Maybe there's another actor or a first or a director or somebody that doesn't treat not just her, but somebody in a respectful way. And you go, that's left a really bad taste in my mouth. I remember my first day and so-and-so said something. It really made me feel so small. And they've got to sort of build yourself back up again now, because then, God, what if you did have a bad day and someone said something and that was my first day? I'm always very aware of that on a set. If somebody...
Did you see Johnny Weldon's latest... Did you follow Johnny Weldon on Twitter?
Oh, my God. I mean,
an actor has one line in the film. Oh, my God. It was so good, wasn't it? It was so brilliantly observed.
He's been knocking out these videos of all different scenarios all over lockdown. We must shout out Johnny Weldon. If you don't, do check him out. Because
it's brilliant.
It's down to a T.
Yeah.
Even that lovely end of that video where he obviously had all his family around. And it was BBC Two. Now, it's coming. It was as perfect as you can be. I mean, I remember going to a screening of a film and they didn't tell the actress that until just going in that she'd been completely revoiced.
Oh, fuck. That's harsh.
So she's there. Oh, she's there on screen, but it ain't her voice.
It's not her voice. That's really harsh when people do that.
Which, you know, I mean, contractually, of course, they're allowed to do it, but on a human level, you would have thought,
you got to tell them.
You would have told them.
So they don't turn up at the
Just before we go in, by the way.
Just before we introduce you on stage after the film, it's not your voice.
Yeah.
That's harsh. Mm. I'm sure Toby Jones told me one time that he'd been completely cut from a film in the same situation. Like, it was he was going to the premiere, and it was a film with Angelica Houston or something that he played her butler or something. I can't remember now. But I'm sure he got completely cut and he only found out at the last minute. I don't think I'm imagining that story. Who knows? I could be. Sorry, Toby, if I
am. I mean, yeah. Well, no, I mean, if it happens to the great Toby Jones, it happens to everybody.
Yeah,
at
it happens
some point,
to everybody. Everybody. We're all, you know, we're a bunch of second choices, or, you know, Harrison Ford was so far down the list for. Well, we talked about this last time, didn't we? Harrison Ford and Indiana Jones. Was it not Tom Selleck first?
Yeah, it was originally Tom Selleck, but the producer of Magnum wouldn't let him out of his contract, would they?
Oh, that's right, that's right. So it came to Harrison. So there you go, he wasn't the first choice. I think that's, you just have to accept those things.
But going back to rejection and going, all right, it didn't go my way and I'll just be frustrated for this time. It's very, yeah. very rare that it comes back. But and as everybody knows when they listen to this podcast, we don't talk too much about specific jobs. But this is very different because I want to sort of get into this because you've worked until you've spoken about something that you've worked really hard at that you've auditioned for and you know you can do it, and then it doesn't go your way. Yeah. Ah, well, we'll flip the tables over, pretend to throw the TV in the backyard, and then we'll come back to it and we'll get back to normal and we'll move on to the next script. But when you got the call saying it didn't work out for Line of Duty for Dryden, and then it was all cast. There was a read-through. They'd started shooting.
Yeah.
Talk me through what happened after that.
Well, first of all, my agent, who was Stephen Hatton at the time, who's now retired and living in France, but who I still love very much. He was a fantastic agent. And he used to be an actor himself.
Mm.
And he was a bulldog. He really, really fought hard for your deal and stuff, and if he believed in you, you really felt like he had your back, you know.
Which is so important. Sorry to interrupt.
Oh
Mark,
God!
But my...
Especially when you're first starting out. I met a few agents at the showcase when we did our drama school showcase, which every drama school does. You know, for those that don't know, you all the actors that from that year that are graduating, they do a showcase, and the drama school invites agents and people from the business along, and you sort of network. You know, it's a chance to get an agent first and foremost, but also meet, you know, whoever, casting directors and producers maybe. So I met a few, three maybe that were interested in me at my showcase. One of whom was Stephen. Another was the agent I ended up going to, which was, I can't remember what the CCA, I think they were called at the time. But Stephen wrote to me when I wrote to the others and told them who I was going with. Stephen was the only one that wrote back and said, "I'm really disappointed you're not coming with me. But if at any point in the future you change your mind or it doesn't work out, let me know." So that really stuck with me.
That never happens.
I know, it was so nice. And so, I mean, I didn't know it never happened because I was just fresh out of drama school. So I was like, oh, that was nice, because he was the only one that replied to my letters, you know. So that stuck with me. And sure enough, two, three years later, it wasn't working with this person. And she was very nice, but she just wasn't me, you know.
But again, talking about how, the way that we're talking about certain things and dealing with rejection and you get used to it, you sort of get to know how a relationship works between you and your agent, because you start to get to know you more, you start to get to know how you work and how the business works, and you go, yeah, this isn't how it should be, or how it's this. It's, there's no balance sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. And I think knowing yourself is a good starting place, I think, mm-hmm. or kind of knowing what you can do, knowing your ability is a good starting place, or believing in yourself. All of those things are a good place to start. And if you, mm-hmm. I mean, I think I was always very ambitious and maybe kind of keen to run before I could walk. And I think that, that kind of motored me along in kind of leaving the agent I was with initially and then sort of remembering Stephen and going, all right, I'll give him a phone. And so I phoned him and I went to meet him and I'm still with him now. He's left. Mm-hmm. So he said when he phoned me to tell me about the audition for Line of Duty, he said, darling, if you get this, it was something quite grandiose, like your career will never be the same again. It was something like that. He said, this will change everything or something.
No,
and this was before the fucking meeting. And I was like, please don't say things like that before I'm going in for an audition. It's just another audition. Please don't, like, pump it up so I'm terrified.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I walked in at the audition at World and met Jed and Kate Rhodes James and
Simon.
Simon wasn't there.
Simon wasn't there.
At my first audition. I didn't get a recall. I'd seen the person who eventually did get the part coming out. As I was going in, he was leaving, and I went, oh, well. So I'd kind of resigned myself before I even had the meeting.
Yeah.
Because I'd seen Robert, and I thought, well, that's that. And sure enough, it was.
Because we can say who it is. It was
Robert Lindsay,
documented.
Yeah.
They cast Robert Lindsay.
Yeah. So, two, three months went by. You know, as you say, they cast Robert, the shooting started, he'd started filming, and for whatever reasons, I don't know because I wasn't there, but they decided to part company. And 3 months later, I got a phone call saying, you know that Line of Duty job? I went, yeah. She went, it's sort of, what was it she said? It's sort of not come back again. It's gone round again. It's coming round again or something. It was something quite kind of ambiguous. And I went, right. She said, they want to have a meeting with you tomorrow at World again. And this was Simon and Jed. And I was like, oh, right. Okay. So I went in and they were like, okay. So, and they were talking like the job's mine. I was like, oh, all right. Okay, cool. And we chatted for, I don't know, 40 minutes. And I was like, right, this fucking, and that was the Friday. That was on the Friday. And I started work on the Monday. I flew over to Belfast on the Saturday, I think.
Mm.
Or the Sunday, probably. And then, started with that big speech in the church on the on the Monday the funeral.
God.
Oh, in front of like 200 extras. Keely Hawes, all you guys, who I'd known and admired from afar for all your various different bits of work that you'd done through the years, because Line of Duty was itself quite young at the time. I'd watched the first series, but I knew all your other work, everybody's other work. And so, I had to get up and do a massive big speech in front of the whole consulate with but 2 days' notice on the phone to Jed going, I'm a DCI. So if that, and just like constantly throwing questions at him, and bless him, he fielded them all, answered them all brilliantly and really, he was brilliant to me, Jed, but just because I think he knew it was such a kind of massive, like, whoop.
Well, it really is. I mean, not only did you have to sort of field that this new information, that this job had come back around, this part from months ago that you'd worked at and yeah. you'd thrown away and it had gone, you've got to sort of scoop everything up within 48 hours notice and start building this character.
Yeah, yeah. But that was, I mean, you know, Jed was the best person to help with that.
Oh, I and mean, he's...
Because he knows everything about
exactly. He's the complete oracle. Yeah,
yeah. So I mean, I just threw question after question after question at him, and he answered them all. I wrote everything down in my little book, and I tried okay, some thought about stuff. But then you get on set with you guys, and Douglas McKinnon, who was the first block director for series two, and. The atmosphere is just so lovely, and you just think, oh man, this is going to be fun. This is, you know, it's going to be really good, and it's a really brilliant. You know, there was some great set pieces, there was some great scenes. You know, some fantastic those interview scenes. I mean, that's when Jed sort of that's when he started doing those, or they became a thing, wasn't it, in series two?
Properly, I mean, it was starting to be cemented in from one, but yeah, from two onwards, it really started to be, as you say, yeah, it was a thing because yeah. people had never seen this on telly before. And, you know, on paper, yeah. you go, what?
19 pages, one scene. Yeah,
yeah. It's like, really? This doesn't really happen. We get through yeah, like five or six incredible. Pages in a day. But yeah, that, I mean, that is the thing that you say, and not to talk too much about work, and we'll move on. But again, going back to that girl that I worked with the other day about you, very experienced coming on, and you realise that this was a very happy set to walk on, even though the material was super intense. You know yeah. that... Once the cameras are not rolling, there's joy and there's happiness and there's a lot of yeah. fun. Like yeah. I've been on some very silly comedy sets where they've been ludicrously serious.
Comedy's a serious business, Craig.
Or almost Shakespearean.
Oh, Matt, but that's the one, especially when you're doing comedy on camera. It's very difficult because if you've done comedy on stage, you're used to getting a laugh, you know? Mm. Comedy on camera is a whole different ballgame. The crew are very generous for the rehearsal. And then it's silence after that, because it has to be, you know? So it's a hard ask to know, because you sort of... Your rhythm, you've just got to feel it, I guess, you know, like you feel anything else. But it's a tricky one doing comedy on camera, I think.
Oh, I think it's, people have heard me say this before on the podcast, of course, because they know that I'm a huge fan of comedy, because what I started out watching as a kid, like in summer holidays, I used to watch Lauren Hardy and Harold Lloyd and Buster Keaton. That was like all my inspiration.
Yeah.
Like, look at this is incredible, because... It was incorporating comedy and romance and stunts, like amazing stunts. Is he yeah, really doing that? Yeah. This is terrifying, but it's funny as well at the same time. People can do this. They did this for a living.
I loved Laurel and Hardy. They were like a staple of my really early years, you know, from maybe... Because my dad loved them. I think he just kind of passed that love on to me. You know, I think, and they were also on Saturday mornings before Swap Shop. They used to show like two Laurel and Hardys or something, you know. Yeah. And so that would have been, I don't know what, late 77, something like that. So I would have been, 8 or something like that. So, I loved them from a very early age and still love them. Very much. And I think I got a lot of my, you kind of absorb that, don't you? That kind of, if you've got an instinct for it, I think that kind of, their timing and their kind of funny bones sort of, you just kind of, I don't know, I think there's quite a lot of them I love doing them, you know, you sort of mimic people, don't you?
Oh yeah.
I think when you're wee. And And I remember, in fact, I'd got an advert years and years and years and years ago. One of my first jobs, or within the first sort of 2 or 3 years I was out of drama school, I got an advert for Twix, I think. And it was never shown. But the reason I got the job was because I did a Stan Laurel double take in the audition. And he said, good Stan Laurel double take. And I went, oh, thanks very much. Yeah.
Brilliant.
And shamelessly nicked, you know.
Oh, God.
But it was never, the ad's been lost in the annals of time somewhere.
Look, we steal from the best.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
And, you know, growing up, I think there was, well, you know, sometimes still nobody better than those, you know, silent to talky comedians. Yeah. And, you know, their technique and their timing, you can mimic it, but I don't know if you can teach it. I don't know. I remember seeing a course for, you know, to come and teach stand-up comedy. And I just went, yeah, I don't know. I don't know that word. I don't know if you can teach that. I think either, I'm sure you can teach somebody maybe the structure of possibly how to write a joke and try and,
yeah,
and try and sell a joke. But is it about, I don't know. I'm fascinated with comedy because I think if you can do comedy,
yeah,
I think you can flip into drama, and people have probably bored because they've heard me say this before, because I think there's such a depth and there's such skill with comedy.
Yes. I think comedy is a lot harder than...
Oh,
than,
absolutely.
I mean, harder, that's the wrong word. But, you know, I mean, it's more complex. It's harder to pull off well. I think you can sort of muddle your way through in a drama. I mean, well, my first job is testament to that, but
oh my God, all of ours. Yeah.
I'm just thinking about that clip of Rebus that I watched. But I was like, what the fuck? But comedy, I don't know, comedy's something, it's like timing. How can you teach somebody timing, you know?
Exactly.
Comedians talking about it is fascinating, but I think it's something you feel. It's not something you can analyze in the same way that acting isn't. You know, acting isn't something you can teach. You can do it or you can't. You have a predisposition to it or you don't. I think you can teach techniques around it.
And you can hone it. But
yeah, and you can hone it and you can practice it. But I don't think you can teach somebody how to act that doesn't have a kind of basic grounding of instinct of it in their bones, you know?
Or to listen. There may be, well, especially sometimes like doing, my son sometimes says, all right, I'm going to do a load of accents for you now. You have to tell me where I'm from in the world. And I go, and he'll do one. I go, did you not get that was Australian? And I went, no. He went, that was quite clearly Australian. I went, no, you can't hear. You're doing one thing and you're listening to yourself doing one thing. And it's like, it's coming out as completely the other thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it is interesting. The education and getting the knowledge. Can you teach certain things? No, I don't think you can with the best one in the world.
I think the arts, I would argue, are hard to teach unless you have a predisposition to something like comedy or like acting or, and when I say comedy, I mean stand-up, you know. I mean, stand-up is a form of acting anyway, isn't it?
Well, yeah, because it's either a character or it's a version.
Who's your favourite stand-up? Do you have a favourite? That's a terrible question, I know, but who'd you listen to? Who'd you love? Who'd you return to?
Live, I would say probably Daniel Kitson. Stuart Lee. I remember the first time I saw Stuart Lee. And it really wasn't his crowd, and it was in Cheltenham of all places. It really wasn't.
Okay.
And it was many years back, and it was a historically Stuart Lee-esque in timing wise, because it just went on. He went on and it was relentless and he was grasping people and he wasn't letting them go.
Oh, I love that. I mean, it was,
and I was dying. Have you read his book?
No.
I forget the title of his book, but there's a lot of dissecting of his routine, and I'll find it out, and I'll put it in the blurb for people who want to listen. But I'll text the name of the book because you'll really, really like it. But yeah, I mean, those two spring to mind because they're kind of unlike anybody else.
Neil told me I've always been aware of Kitson, but I've never watched him. And Neil sent me, and I've only watched the first sort of 5 minutes of it. But the thing that he did in lockdown with all the little bits of paper on the table,
I haven't seen it yet. No, Neil was telling me about it. Yeah, as well.
Yeah, I keep meaning to. The first 5 minutes are unbelievable. Like I was like, holy shit, this is. Kind of all verging on insane, you know, but it's fascinating.
Absolutely.
But Stuart Lee is certainly responsible for or holds the kind of dubious honor of making me laugh more than anybody else has ever made me laugh. And when I went to see him at the south on the South Bank in the Queen Elizabeth Hall, was it, where he did the whole of his last series. That he made, was it series 4, I think?
Of
he did
Comedy
the whole
Vehicle.
Thing
yes,
of Comedy Vehicle. He did it in
Iona.
And it was like 3 hours. He had a break in the middle. But it was the routine about his cat, Jeremy Corbyn, shitting on the Union Jacks. Because it was the England flag. He said the whole joke started as the premise that why, because he was talking about people hanging England flags out their windows, and he was saying I'm trying to imagine the circumstances in which I would hang an England flag out my window, I suppose, if, and then he went on this fucking huge story, which almost ended up in his cat Jeremy Corbyn, his cat is called Jeremy Corbyn, shitting in its litter tray on these England flags, which are the only thing he's managed to. He doesn't have any cat litter, so he's got it. So basically, the joke that made me fucking crease up was the noise of Jeremy Corbyn shitting on the England flag. Just the whole that, what, because he does that so beautifully, paints such a wonderful, detailed, hilarious picture in your head and subverts it just so beautifully. The fart, it was like the fart scene in Blazing Saddles. The first time I saw that, I couldn't speak. You know, I showed that to my wee boy the other day and he almost wet himself.
I can't wait till my son's old enough to watch the whole film.
I know.
My God. Speaking of stand-up, though, Mark, I remember just before lockdown, I was lucky enough to see Alexi Sale live.
Oh.
And it was an absolute masterclass.
Oh,
it was
really?
it was incredible. I'll tell you something else about stand-up comedy in a minute as well. But do you remember old Alexi from years ago?
Yeah, very well.
This big character, this angry character, this scary character. Very much more laid back now. You know, he's much older.
Yeah.
But occasionally flashes of old Alexi would come out and just jolt you out of your seat. It was brilliant to see him on stage. But years and years ago, speaking of comedy, I was working with Dylan Moran, and he said, I'm doing a night of Irish comedy. So it was all Irish comedians at the time in the West End. So we went, and he was like maybe fourth on the bill, third on the bill. So it was him, and it was Tommy Tiernan and somebody else, forgive me, I can't remember. Anyway, headlining, and this is proves, you know, how much sometimes of a comedy snob I can be, was Ardlo Hanlon. Now, it was years ago, and it was the time when weirdly, Ardlo Hanlon was more well-known in the public eye for being in the BBC One sitcom My Hero, which was like, I don't know if you remember.
Yeah,
it was
yeah,
him.
I remember that, yeah.
As a, you know, he was a superhero, just, and he had like, you know, 2.4 children and a wife, and she was the only one yeah. that kind of knew. And it was, it looked, there's a time and place for it, but it was super mainstream. It was exactly the opposite of like what Father Ted had done and was doing over on Channel 4. And I just thought, wait a minute, you've got Tommy Tiernan and Dylan and what? Ardlo Hanlon's headlining. Okay, then, right. So I sat back. One of the greatest stand-up routines I've ever seen. His set
really
was, and we, you know, we spoke before about being on set for us as actors and, you know, technically knowing what's going on, but
yeah,
being relaxed and sort of sitting into it. The most relaxed stand-up on stage. Like, you just go, oh, you're obviously just born to be there with a mic in your hand and making yeah, people yeah. laugh and telling stories. Absolutely. And from then on, I went, I will never be that snobby ever again, because I already judged. I already judged him. I made a judgment, and that was a wrong, yeah. bad call.
Have you ever done it? Have you ever tried it yourself?
No, no.
Have you ever had an inkling to?
I don't know. I think I'm a bit too geeky about it, really, to be honest. I'm just fascinated with the structure of how people... Yeah, on comedy, full stop across the board. Sometimes I think it's like nothing else. I mean, you can show me incredible drama, and I've seen incredible drama over the years, but... you know, like you were saying, to make somebody laugh so much that they don't know if they can stop. Do you remember that feeling at school where you were laughing? You go, I'm not allowed to be laughing here. Or that awful self-indulgent thing that sometimes happens on a set where everybody just gets the giggles.
Where you can't stop.
You can't stop, and you're going, We've got to complete this day, and this
Well, that makes it worse.
Oh, of course it does. Well, it's like being in school; it makes it worse, doesn't it? But to actually get somebody to do, get a crowd of people to do that on stage,
and the best that for me, the best thing is, I mean, this is a personal thing, of course, but because I was always and still am a massive fan of Bill Hicks, and he kind of he did that as well as kind of, although he's dubious misogyny all these years down the line, of course. But when he was at his best, he was transcendent, which is what Stuart Lee does as well. Stuart Lee kind of, he lifts you up out of yourself at the same time as making you belly laugh. And I think that is that's the thing that I love the most about a really clever, hilarious comedian, is that they'll pull your kind of very being apart, you know, because you're absolutely awash at the kind of with love at what they've made you think, and you're also almost wetting yourself at the same time.
Yeah.
That kind of juxtaposition, whenever that can happen in life, is always beautiful and exquisite. I think those combative, symbiotic feelings, you know,
and you know, sometimes it can be quite a rare thing. Because I love seeing lots of stand-ups and lots of comedians. And sometimes I do, you know, kind of look around and go, oh, why are you laughing at that? I don't get that. Look, it's subjective, it's fine, it's not for everybody. And certain people find other people funny, and that's fine. But while we're talking about comedy, we did mention about comedy on stage, which, you know, you can hear and the beat, and also you've got the laughter coming back, so you know you're on the right track.
Yeah.
And, you know, for instance, if you're doing, and I said I wouldn't talk about jobs too much, but if you're doing something like Catastrophe, say, which is deeply hilarious, but also deeply romantic and actually quite emotional.
Yeah, of course.
Works on lots of levels. You can't hear anything back. You've got a generous crew, but they've got a job to do, and part of that is to be silent. But if you're doing the other thing, which is multi-camera with an audience, that's something else. And I don't know if that was, did you shoot Porridge like that, or was that
amazing?
You did.
That was amazing. Right. That's the best of both worlds, because you have the.
But again, a completely different skill set altogether.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I was terrified. I was really, really terrified at first. But Kev Bishop was an old hand at it, and he kind of
absolutely
he knew how to work the crowd, and I sort of. As soon as he started, I went, oh, yeah, you can do that. You can stop because you're on camera and you can have a wee joke with the audience and then you can go back into the scene. It's like amazing, By the end of filming it, I was just having a blast. It was the best job. And people are really generous. They come because they want to be entertained. And it was, it was Clement and Lafreny. It was Porridge, it was...
absolute legends. I mean,
it was, it had its faults, I think, and it was, well, whatever it was. It was kind of, I suppose, in a way it was dated, but I don't think they gave it a chance. I don't think they gave it enough of a chance. Mm. It had one series and I think they mucked around with the timing, the schedule, and, if it started off at 9 o'clock and then the next week it was on at 11 or something, or a couple of weeks later it was on at 11, and you're just like, oh, you're it seems like you're deliberately trying to fuck us off, get this cancelled.
Which is odd, isn't it? Because when you look at something like that and you go, wait a minute, I know what is going to be delivered here. This is quite clearly an 8:30 show.
Yeah.
There'll be certain jokes in it that certain age groups will get and certain others won't. You see, that's the thing. That's what we were talking about, comedy, why it's so difficult to get right. And whereas a drama might be completely fine, inoffensive, mediocre, maybe. And people go, yeah, just keep on making those.
I know,
they're totally fine.
I think it was kind of... There were probably several problems in that it was, you're at a time when we're much more kind of, as we bloody should be, aware of, equality in the workplace and representation in the workplace. I think, it might have been an idea to set it in a female prison for a start, it was a bunch of men. And that was maybe, setting it off slightly askew, going to use my sailing analogy again, you'll be happy to know. But that boat was, the sail was slightly askew on that particular launch from the word go, I guess. I was so excited because it was such a massive part of my youth, that show. I used to, and again, going back to the timing thing, it was like, whatever it was, Friday, 8 o'clock, you would know you were there. I know the landscape's changed now with iPlayer and streaming and stuff, but, you would make sure you were in front of the telly, you would, plan it all, sit down as a family because Porridge was on, or the Two Ronnies was on, or whatever it was, Morecambe and Wise, whatever it was, But yeah, it was a great, great pleasure to do. And it was a massive pleasure to work with Ian and Dick, because they're masters of their game.
Absolutely.
And it was sad. It was sad that it didn't, it was bittersweet because it didn't get to go again. But, as I say, there was kind of reasons probably for that, that were probably kind of, understandable. Jobs are like your kids, aren't they? You kind of love each one dearly and you are very protective of it. And I loved that. I loved Porridge because it taught me a new skill set apart from anything else.
But again, you know, we're talking about rejection again. That's kind of a different type of rejection because everybody's worked really, really hard and you've thrown it out there. And after it's been thrown out there, you go, well, it's kind of out of my hands now. There's nothing I can do to sell it even more. So I understand that when you talk about scheduling and you think, oh God, was she deliberately trying to do this because we've offered something up. We've worked really, really hard.
Yeah.
But I suppose it's a bit like reviews, you know, I mean,
yeah.
Can you read a review during a run of a play?
No.
I don't think so.
I've done it, and it's a bad idea. Because we're all sensitive creatures. You know, if you read, it doesn't, as many people have said, it doesn't matter if it's good or bad. You know, they both affect you in an adverse way. Because, you know, you're if somebody points out a little bit that you do, and this has happened, this specific thing has happened to me, where somebody's going, I read in a review when Mark Bonner, da, 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 something, I can't remember what it was or what I was doing, but he's pointed out a specific bit. And every night after that review or after I read it, I would go, this is that bit. You know, it plants a little thing in your head. You don't want to be made self-aware of what you're doing.
Mm.
You know, if it works, it works with the audience and you, and that's the way you should leave it. Afterwards, you can read reviews and get angry at Charles Spencer. That's fine.
But it's a little bit like somebody on a set coming up to you when the camera's turning around and it's on you and you've already done this scene a few times and the other person that you're playing opposite says to you, do you know that bit when you do that?
Oh,
I love that when you do that. And do you know what? Action.
I know. Exactly. It's exactly that. Yeah. Funny you say that, but I was in mine and Neil's, second last scene the other day on Friday. It was on.
Mark, just to put it into context, this is the ITV drama that is about Alexander Litvinenko.
Yeah, that's right. Me and Neil are playing coppers in it, and David Tennant's playing Litvinenko.
Mm.
I literally just finished on filming on Friday with Neil Masco, who, for those who don't know. We met, I know you're really great pals with Neil, but we met sort of about, 7 years ago, was it, doing Eric Ernie and Me.
Yeah.
And we've remained in touch ever since. I love him. But I was watching him the other day. It was such a pleasure to work together again. And now that we know each other a bit better as well, I guess, but I was watching him when it was on his close-up. It was really close as well. I could see the shot. And I was watching him going, oh, my God, you're fucking fantastic. You know, just I was kind of, you know, that, and I was still in the scene. I was his eye line and I was doing my lines and everything for him. But I found myself in those kind of situations where you find yourself watching someone rather than sort of being in the scene with them.
Mm.
I was just watching him going, wow, what you're doing is really fucking special.
Yeah.
And I just had one of those moments, you know. Why did I start talking about that again? Because you were saying, if somebody says in the middle of a scene, I love that bit, you do. And I almost did. I almost went, and he wasn't finished. And I had to stop myself because I almost went, that was brilliant. And I went, oh no, wait till after. And in fact, I texted him the day after. He texted me the day after and I texted him back and said, and listen, what you were doing yesterday was fucking amazing, man. So good. It's such a pleasure to witness or work with people. It's such a pleasure to get the opportunity to work with people in that way. And I mean, acting, you know, it's such a pleasure to do it. I love this job. I love that it changes every 2 or 3 months, you know, because I've got a very short attention span. And I think it's wonderful. It's a wonderful thing to do, to create something out of nothing and entertain people. It's a remarkable thing to be able to do, and I'm so blessed to be able to do it, you know.
Has there ever been times where it hasn't gone to plan? And I mean, who has a plan? But where you've thought, yeah, this is getting too tough for me. I don't think I can carry on doing this.
Yeah. Back in, well, there's been a few times, actually. I mean, I've had two periods. I've had one period of a year out and one period of 15 months out. And one 9 months. So the 9 months one was probably the most recent. I don't know if it was actually. But like for big blocks, you know, that's quite a big block not to have fuck all. Mm. And it was right after the first sort of lead part I'd done on telly in a thing called Paradox with Tamsin Outhwaite and Eamon Elliott. And Cheeky Okonkwo, we the four of us were the sort of main parts in this show, and it was a good show, and it had quite ambitious ideas and stuff, and it's like sort of like sci-fi mixed with cop thing, but for whatever reasons it only did one series, after it was broadcast, I was thinking. Okay, I've shown what I can do on telly in a sort of like a big part, you know. Here we go. Here we go. And the phone didn't ring for 9 months. And I was like, oh, so that was hard. That was hard. That was really, really hard. But that's, you know, that's just one of those things, you know, it's a surprise and it's, you know, it's, there's always, you know, I met for things. So but you kind of, that keeps your hope going, you know, when you have meetings, when you have auditions, you wait to hear about stuff. So you're thinking, you know, that keeps your spirits up, I suppose. Yeah. And it's meet for some stuff, but I just didn't get anything.
It's interesting what we've been talking about. There's been a through line about the longer that you've been doing it, you sort of, well, you get to know and you get to learn and you get to accept and sit with certain things about how to behave and rejection and all that. But that's that's another thing that sort of, you know, and I'm sure, I mean this in the right way, but slightly naive that you went, okay, here we go.
No, totally. Because I thought, right, I've done a really good job, go.
but that's the thing, isn't it? It just doesn't play out like it doesn't work like that.
No.
Like a really good friend of mine a few years ago won a BAFTA and absolutely well deserved, so proud, brilliant for him.
Yeah.
The phone did not ring.
Fucking hell.
Scripts didn't even come in because he kind of found out people just thought, oh, well, he'll be totally busy now. So no one just went, he'll be fine. He's like, no, I'm not fine.
It's It's weird because being self-employed or freelance or whatever we are, you kind of, because if you get a promotion at work, right? If you get, if you work for the civil service or whatever, you get a promotion, you've got a promotion. Somebody's thought you're good enough to do that job. There you go. There's a pay rise. There's a bit more money. And you can do that as long as you're fit to, as long as you're fit and healthy, and you'll hopefully get another promotion later on, blah blah blah, and that's the way it works. But yeah, for freelancers, you get a pat on the back or a BAFTA, or well done, and you've completed a piece of work, and you've done it to the best of your abilities, and you think you're all right in it, and then what? Nothing. That's it. You don't get any money. You don't get a job. You don't get a, you know, for, so it's the not knowing. The not knowing is a killer sometimes.
But also
the uncertainty is a killer sometimes.
But also it's the not knowing and the uncertainty that kind of keeps you driven and keeps you alive. So it's kind of,
it's double-edged. It does. It's terrifying. But I mean, yeah, no, you're right. It does. It certainly keeps you going. It certainly keeps you hungry. It certainly keeps your senses sharpened. It certainly keeps you fit, in my case. I always joke that if I didn't do this job, I'd be 25 stone. Because I fucking love food. And I don't really drink anymore, but I used to love my booze as well. But yeah, I always joked that if I didn't do this job, I'd be the size of a hoose.
Even though, and I'm repeating myself, that I don't talk about jobs, but because we've spoken about comedy so much and we're both so clearly quite passionate about it.
We've done nothing but talk about jobs.
I know. But in a way, do you know why? Do you know?
Which is fine. I'm happy with that.
I know, but do
more.
You know one of the reasons when I started this years ago, when I was having conversations with actors, why I never wanted to talk about jobs too much is I never wanted it to be self-indulgent. I was always very scared about that. But sometimes with things like this, it just happens and we do talk about it and there's no in-jokes. There's no sides. It's not self-indulgent. It's just two people having a conversation, which is why I'm really enjoying it. I'm not trying to veer it down another track because it's organically going the way that it is,
and it's really lovely.
But to be offered to play Eric Morecambe, I couldn't think of anything more scary.
More fucking right. Yes. Fuck, terrifying. Oh my God. But you know, I didn't. I do need to say,
and obviously you know this anyway, it was fucking brilliant, and kudos to you and Maskell and Neil Forsyth as well, because it's a blind bit of talent, and you know, two comedians who are part of my history who hold close to my heart, so I would be, which is one of the reasons why, and I'm sure they're incredible, but I'm incredibly nervous about watching the Laurel and Hardy film.
Oh, it's beautiful.
I know. I've read the script.
I saw it just about 2-3 weeks ago. It's beautiful. You'll love it. You'll love it because it comes from the best possible place.
No, I read the script and it was brilliant, but I was just like, I don't know if I'll be able to sort of detach myself away from the history of two people who I adore.
You will.
I know I will. I'm being silly. But anyway,
because I'm a massive fan as well. And I was a little bit like that. I was thinking, oh God, how is it going to be? And I wept. I wept buckets at the end. Yeah. It was just gorgeous. Absolutely gorgeous. But I'd also mention Tomkinson as well, Stephen Tomkinson, who played an absolute blinder as Eddie Braben.
He really did.
He was astonishing.
Yes.
Really astonishing.
It was incredible.
It was absolutely terrifying. When I first got the call about it, my first reaction was, oh, me? No. And Lucy was like, oh, stop being so stupid. You know, you're good. She helped me with the accent, no end, you know, because she's from Wigan. Because I was doing her dad at first. She went, that's not Lancashire. That's not Morecambe. That's Wigan. You're doing a Wigan accent. I was like, okay. Anyway, it was terrifying. But I had 2 weeks before my meeting to prepare. So I just watched him. I watched him and watched him and watched him. And, you know, the family were sick of the sound of me going, oh, ho, ho! You know, everything. But I mean, up until, you know, I woke up on the morning of the meeting, 2 weeks after I got the first call, thinking, I'm not right for this. I'm not right.
Were you almost trying to sort of talk yourself out of actually?
I don't know.
Because it can be done. We can do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it was probably, I don't know, it was probably a bit of self-preservation, but I actually genuinely didn't think I was right for it. And I thought, well, I'm going to bring a kind of like whatever, you know, I'll do him. And I'll go along and I'll, you know, because I didn't know how to do it. So I'd watched him and I'd listened and I'd practiced and I went along and it was terrifying. And they got me to go in with a couple of Ernies as well. And neither of whom were Maskell, it has to be said. But both of whom are very good. I kind of enjoyed it. And I tell you what, the Neil Forsyth was brilliant in the meeting. He was so enthusiastic and, which he's like anyway, Neil, he's just like, you know, got such an amazing energy. So he was brilliant. He was like laughing and he was like going, try this, try that, I do that. And he was Scottish as well. So we had a little bit of a, you know, thing about Scotland or whatever. So, it happened. And then I went, oh, well, that was that. It was good fun, blah, blah, blah. And went home and then the phone rang and I got it. And I was like, oh, fucking what? And I've never been so scared going into a rehearsal room with Stephen Tompkinson and Neil Maskell. I didn't know Neil at the time. But both of them were, I mean, I was huge fans of, you know, weeks before I'd watched Kill List and bloody loved Utopia. And he, you know, he's sublime. Neil's a fucking sublime actor. And Tompkinson, man, fucking hell, he's, you know, Drop the Dead Donkey was always on when I was in my, you know, 20s. So, yeah, I was just, you know, walking into a hotel room. That was another story. Walking into a rehearsal room with them two trying to do Eric Morecambe was absolutely petrifying and remained petrifying until I think we actually came to do it. And then I sort of thought, okay, I'm kind of feeling him a little bit. I think I'm sort of, and obviously hair and makeup did the most fucking incredible job. Oh my God, that team were just amazing. And that really, you know, when you see yourself and you go, oh my God, right, okay. So yeah, that really helped. And the walk and his energy and the pipe, when I got the pipe.
Oh, the pipe.
That really helped. Things that really, little things, you just help you hold yourself a different way just everything, you know, it's a fascinating sort of process to go through, you know, to get yourself into that.
Yeah, because it's so one thing creating a character with a fresh original script, and it's one when you've got all the responsibility knowing that this is a person that made people's Christmas Day. Like, Christmas Day was certainly in my house and many, many other people's was built around, right, well, we need to get sat down for 7:15.
It's going to be on at 8 o'clock.
Welcome Wise Christmas special is going to be on and this is going to be wall to wall for an hour of just hit after hit after hit. And also, I know, the glasses.
But there was loads of sketches that I didn't know that were fucking brilliant. And like Mr. Memory is one of the all time genius comedy sketches, because he comes out it's a silly joke, but it's so good. He comes out with no trousers on. That's how the sketch starts. And apparently what was really wonderful about the job was learning that these things, for example, the idea for him not to come to come on without his trousers on was like a really last minute thing in the wings. You know, he went, I'll take my trousers off. And, you know, it was like, oh my God, but that's a fucking
genius.
It's a stroke of genius, you know? It's brilliant. So that team, that, you know, Morecambe and Wise and Braben, that team were just fucking astonishingly good for so many years, you know, top of their game. I mean, there was a lot of, you know, and Neil says this, there was a lot of, like Monty Python, like all that, there's a lot of, when you watch an episode of Monty Python now, you sort of, you know, there's two or three hits in it you know, really funny bits, and the rest is a bit like, yeah, okay. And there was quite a bit of that with Morecambe and Wise on the weekly show, you know, not the Christmas special. That was always like a big glitzy spectacular.
That was hit after hit, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But on the weekly shows, yeah, there was a few sort of like, oh, yeah, this is quite of its time, or, you know, but when the classics hit, fucking hell, Mr. Memory was just, beautiful. Arsenal! So, oh my God, Mr. Memory is one of my favourite characters, I think.
But Mark, I'm just going to round it off now and just go back to when Stephen Hatton called you up and said, you know, look, if you get this, and I'm not quoting him,
this is going to change your life.
But did it change things?
Line of Duty? Yeah. Oh, yes, without a doubt. I think... I don't think any of us really had, because the first series was brilliant, but I think the second series, for whatever reason, touched a nerve in the public psyche. I hate those fucking things.
It touched a nerve with the public psyche, and everybody went wild.
No, but something happened around series two. You know, I think, you know, a Jed storytelling mixed with, you know, Keely and me coming in to join an already fucking amazing established cast with just a great fucking story. Mm. You know, it's a great story. And some brilliant sort of coup de théâtres like... I've forgotten her name, shit. Falling out the window at the end of episode one.
Jess,
that's right. And just great people, like, you know, the wonderful Tony Pitts, who you've had on this.
God,
you know,
yeah.
I fucking love Tony.
Yeah, me too.
And it was a fascinating thing to be a part of. And yes, it really captured the public's imagination.
That really captured the public's imagination.
But, you know, it kind of went a bit mental. And it was a real thrill to be a part of it, you know. And it did change things. Yeah, undoubtedly. That, alongside sort of Catastrophe, probably around about the same time I was doing Catastrophe, those two jobs... Yeah, made a kind of difference, I think, to my career, I suppose.
Yeah,
you know, and I'm eternally, eternally grateful to them and you all and Robert Lindsay. And
well, it's like I always say, you know, when I, you know, talk to, you know, students and younger actors, I just say, you know, it's just about timing, it's just about luck, and sometimes it's just one job, and it's just going to change everything. Yeah.
It's about being prepared. Being prepared so that when that happens, you're prepared. Yeah.
What a beautiful way to end it, Mark Bonner. You're an absolute star. And I
it's been lovely, mate.
Enough for
coming. We're almost
on
at the Witcher now.
Yeah, I know. We'll get to our scratcher.
Are you working tomorrow?
No. I'm up early on a big drive to go and collect a small 10-year-old boy.
Oh, mate, good luck.
Oh, cheers, man. Look, loads of love, Mark, and I'll see you in person hopefully very soon.
Somewhere down the line, yeah.
And another episode is done. What did I tell you? Yes. We spoke about certain jobs and slight preparation and learning and dealing with rejection. But you got who Mark Bonner is. And if you ever meet him, say hello, because you know what? He'll stop and he'll have a chat with you. He's brilliant. And if you're an actor and you haven't worked with Mark Bonner, you are in for an absolute treat. Certain things that we touched on early on in this episode, Bull, the film starring Neil Maskell, directed by Paul Andrew Williams, is coming out at cinemas this Friday. It's on Odeon's Picture Houses. Google it, Bull. Go and see it. Go and support British independent cinema. Do that. because they need the support, and I can't wait to see it. I know it's going to be a brilliant film. Reports back from people that have seen it have said it is nothing short of fantastic. And what do you expect from an actor of Maskell's talent and Paul Andrew Williams, who, if you haven't seen, I think I might be right in saying his debut film. If I'm wrong, I apologise, but it's called London to Brighton. Ironically, as soon as I'm recording this in Brighton, it's a fantastic film. Seek out London to Brighton. And if you want to catch up with what Mark is doing on television, go to BBC iPlayer. You can start by watching Series 1 of Guilt. Rinse that, then jump straight into Series 2 of Guilt, which is playing now on the BBC iPlayer if you're in the UK, or you've got like a cheeky VPN and you can see it. Apparently you can do that. I'm not saying to do it. Apparently you can do it. Oh, it's good to be back. I'm talking very fast and I'm slightly tired. So I'm going to finish my glass of red wine and get to bed. And I'll see you all next week. Okay? Thank you so much for downloading, subscribing. Let's have a chat. You know where we are. We're on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. We try and get back to you. If you want to drop us an email, you can. If you want, you can hear my voices going because I'm tired. It's twoshotpod@gmail.com. Until next week, I've been Craig Parkinson. He's been producer Griff, and this has been the Two Shot Podcast. You take care. I'll see you next week. The Two Shot Podcast is presented by me, Craig Parkinson, recorded and produced by Thomas Griffin for Splicing Block. Our music, our brilliant music, is courtesy of Then Thickens.